Most Australians never darken the doorway of a church, so why do almost 90% of you still want a church in your neighbourhood? Hello, Andrew West here. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. The man who spent 50 years studying Australians' attitudes will explain this paradox.
The people who are saying this have no intention of going, but they say, you know, we love to see little groups of people outside church on Sunday morning, almost as though they're saying it's nice to know that sort of stuff still goes on.
The writer and mind reader Hugh Mackay discusses his new book. And Barack Obama won't apologise for the US decision to drop an atomic bomb on Hiroshima in 1945, but should he? Now, the Guildford 4, the Birmingham 6, the Maguire 7, sometimes it takes a headline-friendly phrase to raise the case of political prisoners, and that's certainly true with a group in Iran whom the US Commission on International Religious Freedom have called the Baha'i Seven. Five men and two women are now beginning their ninth year in jail for trying to organise their religion. 27 leading Australian lawyers and former judges have written to Iran's ambassador to Australia seeking the release of the Baha'i leaders. The spokesman for the group is a former New South Wales Attorney General and Supreme Court Judge John Dowd. He told me why the Baha'i Seven were arrested.
They were largely running the organisation for the Baha'i people. They were just organising. They weren't proselytising. They weren't doing anything evil and were arrested on spurious charges which have not really been formulated publicly.
And it's an interesting contradiction in the sense that Iran over the past couple of decades has tried to build its reputation for religious pluralism, special places for Christians and Jews, for Zoroastrians, and yet the Baha'i continue to be left out of that religious freedom equation. Why is that?
What they're projecting is not the truth. Although the Zoroastrians and Christians and Jews are mentioned in the Constitution, they are still persecuted in various ways and discriminated against. But it's the ones who are not mentioned. The Baha'is are non-persons. They're not allowed religious freedom. Their marriages are not recognised. They can't conduct funerals. But also non-conforming Shia Muslims, people that are Shia, which is the state religion, state form of Islam, are not treated like ordinary people and some are persecuted. The Sufi Muslims, for instance, are not mentioned. They are discriminated against. So right throughout society is a major discrimination against anyone who is not within the view of the Shia Islamic Council. Correct.
So what specific charges were levelled against these seven Baha'i leaders some 8 years ago? Because it all seems rather fuzzy.
Yes, it is fuzzy. They're not given access to their families. They're not given access to their lawyers. The charges are vague charges about working against the state. Baha'is are treated as, because their main buildings are in Israel, treated as pro-Israeli, and they were finally dealt with by a court on no evidence and sentenced initially to 20 years, and that was brought back to 10 years, but of course not necessarily backdated, because it was 20 months after their arrest that the court procedure, such as it is, took place.
Wasn't the official rationale, at least the one that was cited by the US State Department, some form of espionage?
That's right. That was the allegation, but no specifics. There were no specific allegations of espionage. There was no evidence of espionage.
John, as I understand it as well, their detention could indeed even be illegal under Iran's own law. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Under Iran's laws, they're entitled to know what charges are against them. They're entitled to have a judgment if there is a judgment against them. That has not been furnished. The results of the hearing have not been provided to them. It's in breach of Iran's own laws, but also it's in breach of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which of course Iran has ratified, but of course not incorporated into domestic law, but it's in breach of international norms.
I think the US State Department has said it regards these prisoners as prisoners of conscience. Do they meet an international definition of prisoners of conscience?
In practical terms, yes. They're entitled under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights to freedom of conscience, freedom of religion. So they are prisoners of conscience by any means, meaning of the word.
Now, John, the US and Iran have now struck a new deal, the nuclear deal, but it's set to put the whole Iran-Western relationship on a new footing. Can that new political arrangement be leveraged to get some leniency, some mercy for these prisoners?
Look, Iranians are going to want to trade and interact not just with the US, but all countries, such as Canada. To do that, they're now going to be forced to be transparent. The world of electronic communication means that everyone's going to know what's going on, and I'm delighted that this opaqueness, this complete shroud that comes on religious freedom will be gradually, forcibly removed.
Do we know much about the conditions in which the Baha'i leaders are being held?
We do a little, in that people that have been inside and come out have said how good the seven are in terms of helping people in communicating and so on. It is understood they are not in appalling circumstances, but we don't have a lot of detail.
What do you want the Australian government to do in pressing this case?
A, we want to remind the Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, as to what her obligations are, to make her conscious that she's got to raise these matters, as we do with places like China and so on. All of our interrelations, we raise human rights matters. She needs to raise the human rights, because it's not only these seven. There are other people of other religions, but there are also trade union people. The teachers, high-ranking Teachers Federation of Iran, are in custody as well. So it's not just religion, but it's other forms of and structures that are under attack there.
Look, just finally, you know the practicalities. Can a country like Australia afford a moral, human rights-based foreign policy?
There are no perfect countries. We're a lot better than most countries that we have to deal with. And for the weaknesses that we have in certain areas, nevertheless, generally, we are in favour of human rights and enforce human rights and have a lot of human rights protected here, then we have a right to do it. If they reply about what we do badly, then let them reply. But nevertheless, raising these issues makes it more likely that the people will be released.
The International Commission of Jurists, Australia President, former Attorney General and Judge John Dowd. Barack Obama visits Japan next week for a meeting of G7 countries. The agenda is mainly trade and the global economy, but some diplomats are worried that the G7 will be overshadowed by a side trip the president will make to Hiroshima. That's the city where the US dropped an atomic bomb in 1945, helping to end World War II, but killing about 100,000 people. The president will not apologise for the bomb, but his mere visit has reignited a debate about the ethics of regret. In the Lowy Institute magazine, Robert Kelly from Pusan University in South Korea writes about the Hiroshima visit. Does he think Barack Obama would perhaps privately like to say sorry?
Yeah, that is actually a really good question, whether or not they believe it. My guess is the president himself does. I mean, this president is a little bit different from previous American presidents. He is sort of a student of Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela and really does seem to believe that reconciliation involves admissions of error and mistake and things like that. There is an argument that says that the bomb drop was not necessary. I don't find that entirely persuasive myself, but I do think that the president is sort of aware that use of American force killed thousands of people and helped really sort of like reset the decades to follow. And I think that he's sort of aware of that. But the politics are terrible. So I think that's probably why it didn't happen.
I want to ask you about those politics in a moment, but you've said in your piece that Obama's impulse to apologize is morally laudable. Why do you believe that's the case?
You know, I mean, international politics is sort of a dark and unnecessarily sharp and zero-sum competition between states, and I think that often leads to bad behavior, and that allows nationalism particularly to sort of dominate the way states talk about themselves and others. And I think this creates unnecessarily competitive pressures in the system. It would be better if the states could be a little bit more humble and a little bit less arrogant and a little bit less nationalistic. I think it might reduce the likelihood of conflict. This is certainly something that you can see if you compare East Asia, where I live, to the European Union, right? I mean, the European Union really has moved beyond conflict, in part because elites in the European Union realized just how bad nationalism was, and that kind of like relentless national self-assertion, especially in the 19th century, and where that led. And if you look in East Asia, you just don't have that at all, where discourses of nationalism and racism are still deeply entrenched. And that's one of the reasons why people look at East Asia and they worry about Chinese behavior and stuff like that, and they worry about the possibility of conflict out here.
Now, Secretary of State John Kerry, and you referred to this earlier, is said to have found his visit to Hiroshima very harrowing. So is being upset or being moved by something enough reason to apologize if you believe there's been a strong moral case for it happening in the first place? I mean, basically, if you believe there's a strong moral case for the bomb, I know it's highly debated. I'm just wondering if feeling that it was a harrowing experience is enough of a justification.
Well, I mean, it's part of the pushback on the apology has been that the moral argument behind the bomb drop isn't nearly as clear as the moral argument against, say, like the Cultural Revolution in China, right? Or something like the Holocaust or like Stalin's purges or something like that. In the weeks running up to the bomb drop in 1945, and the Americans genuinely believed at the time that the bomb drop really would make a difference. Now, there's a whole argument out there that says it was not actually the bomb drop that led the Japanese cabinet to make the final decision. It was actually Stalin's invasion of Manchuria. But the American elites at the time didn't know that. So I would argue that given the information that they had and the length and duration of the war, that the bomb drop is still probably morally defensible. I think that's one of the reasons why the president can't really apologize so much, because a lot of people think that it was justified at the time. Was it terrible? Yes. The problem there, of course, is that war has always been terrible. And then the argument then becomes, well, why did the people at Hiroshima deserve an apology, but not the people who died in Dresden? Pretty soon it just becomes this tangle of sort of like moral claims to victimhood. And I think this is ultimately what probably undid the effort to get to an apology on it.
Let's talk about some of the specific roadblocks that you observe, even if an apology were to be desirable. Why would the Chinese and the Koreans object to an apology?
For China and North Korea, Japan is very useful as a historical enemy, continually understood as that, right? But Japan, South Korea, and North Korea, all, I would argue, they're all post-colonial states. And so all of them continually bring up this narrative of what Japan did to them in the first half of the 20th century in order to justify the way that they're governed and structured today. You know, North Korea is probably the most egregious about this. North Korea still acts like the Japanese are just about to invade them and stuff like that. And this is all very useful, right? Because this is how the communist parties of North Korea and China, for example, justify their control, right? That, you know, we need a strong party at the helm because we're surrounded by these enemies. So if you actually admit that Japan today isn't really like that at all, that Japan today is actually in demographic decline, militarily, it's rather weak. It spends less than 1% of gross domestic product on defense. It's deeply tied to the United States, which wouldn't let Japan act offensively even if it wanted to. None of these things are useful for the political narrative necessary to explain the dictatorships of North Korea. So they're just completely blocked out. It's much more useful to continue to dredge up the ghosts of the 1940s to explain why North Korea and China are the way they are.
And why do you say, fascinatingly, that Japanese conservatives would be against an apology? The very people that you would have thought would be demanding American repentance.
It is actually really curious. You would imagine that the nationalist community in Japan, which can get pretty nationalist, right? I mean, these are the people who still think that the war was a good idea and that they were liberating East Asia from white Western slavery and stuff like that. I mean, they still talk like this. But they don't, actually, because Japan's behavior, the Imperial Army's behavior in the 30s and 40s particularly, is what really drives the Japanese left's moral argument for pacifism. That is to say that the constitutional constraints in Japan and its military, its use of force since the 1940s, that is all based on the argument that when Japan did have the right to use force, it went crazy with it in the 30s and 40s. That's the moral power of the Japanese left to sort of convince the Japanese population not to go for rearmament or something. The Japanese right is like, that's 70 years ago. We don't want to talk about that anymore. That was a long time ago. let's look at what's coming in the future, which is North Korea with nuclear weapons and the Chinese with this, you know, large economy and big navy and stuff like that. And so even if we did terrible stuff a couple generations ago, we have to deal with the threats on our doorstep. And this is the debate that's been going inside in Japan for the last 15 or 20 years.
Yes, I noticed that a right-wing Japanese nationalist journalist, Hiroyuki Fujita, who's very well known, says that an apology is not necessary and it will create, quote, a ceaseless round of apologies, fearing the Japanese will be required to apologize even for the treatment, for example, of American and Australian prisoners of war.
Yeah, and see, that's the other thing, too, is that once you start to go down this route, then pretty soon everybody's sort of on the spot. What would happen, though, is basically this would be sort of demanded of the democracies only, right? And so you would get this kind of like moral asymmetry in which the Japanese would be expected to apologize for a great deal, and the Chinese, of course, wouldn't apologize for anything, and nobody really wants to sort of get into that back and forth and sort of blur the moral debate between China and Japan. Again, I'm kind of sympathetic to this because today, Japan is easily, definitely morally preferable to China. I mean, we really can't avoid that. And if you start dredging up World War II all over again, this will play into the hands of the Chinese. This is why the Japanese don't want to do it. And this is why the Americans are so hesitant on this, because it's ultimately the Chinese that would benefit from the Japanese being pushed into apologizing more and more for the war. The moral argument, which I think which your show is about, that's more difficult, right? Because the Japanese did, of course, have a terrible record of sadism regarding POWs during the war, and it gets tangly quickly.
Professor Robert Kelly from Pusan University in South Korea, and you're with Andrew West on RN News Radio, Radio Australia, and online. For 50 years, Hugh Mackay has been reading the minds of Australians as a social researcher, and more recently as an author. In his new book, Beyond Belief, he argues organised religion is critical even for the non-believer. Earlier this week, I caught up with Hugh Mackay at St. James Anglican Church in Sydney's CBD, where he once sang in the choir. And we started by discussing a headline figure in his book, the McCrindle research finding that 88% of non-churchgoers still want a church in their neighbourhood.
Essentially, I think what people are saying is we've turned away from the institutional church. We think of the institution as potentially corrupt, at its most extreme in the form of child sexual abuse, but protecting its own power, all that sort of stuff. But at the local level, yes, this extraordinary figure, almost 90% of non-churchgoers like a church in the suburb. And I think what they're saying is the people who go to church, they're people who are likely to have kindness, compassion, charity as their drivers. They're likely to personify at least some of the Christian virtues. And we like the idea that that has a sort of leavening effect on the community. The people who are saying this have no intention of going, but they say, you know, we love to see little groups of people outside church on Sunday morning, almost as though they're saying it's nice to know that sort of stuff still goes on.
Well, I wonder also, they like a place in a community that isn't about commerce. Of course, people put money in the plate at church. This church here has a small coffee shop, but commerce is not the driving function. They like somewhere in their community that, what, isn't just about money and transactions.
Yes. At a time in the evolution of our culture, when everything is more and more about money, and specifically more and more about me and my wealth and my happiness and all that sort of stuff. So here I think they're seeing a symbol of something that most Australians would still say about Australia, even though only 8% of them will attend church weekly, about 15% once a month or more often, but they will still say we're basically a Christian country, and come census time, 61% tick Christian. So there's something about the values associated with basic Christianity that they sign up to, often explicitly saying we don't sign up to the dogma, don't ask us about virgin birth and resurrection and Trinity and miracles and all that sort of stuff. It's not about beliefs, it's about values.
Okay, so 3 to 4 million Australians going to church once a month, despite the growing social pressure not to do so. They're your words. What is that social pressure, and how and why are people overcoming it, defying that social pressure?
20% of Australians are saying no religion, by the way, and that's a figure that's been growing steadily. But the 61% who are ticking Christian but not going to church have become very disillusioned or disenchanted with the institution. And people who do go to church say that among their non-church-going friends, it's seen as kind of, you know, like, haven't you heard? You know, people don't do that, as though it's somehow slightly embarrassing. So there's an embarrassment factor. But again, all these people who are not going to church but ticking Christian are sending their kids to church schools. So here we've got church attendance going through the floor, as if to say, we are secular, we're anti the institution, but enrolment at church schools going through the roof.
Tell me about the Victorian property developer, Hugh, who designed a purpose-built suburb with a church. Now, there was no definite commitment from any religious denomination, Christian or otherwise, to be in that purpose-built community, but the developer himself wanted a space for church or worship.
Yes, I've told his story in some detail in the book, but he is strongly of the view that a church in a community, like a shopping centre or a library or a medical practice, ought to be there, ought to be part of the life of the community. So, and he wasn't particularly suggesting that everyone would come to church, but that the presence of a faith community within the larger community would mean there'd be a group of people having their faith nurtured, being encouraged to be more loving, more compassionate. And so he now insists, as part of each community development, that a space will be set aside, not necessarily recognisable as a traditional church. In fact, the one that he was describing to me was in a commercial centre upstairs above a series of shops. He wasn't remotely denominational in his attitude, but he was just saying this would not be a proper community if it didn't have that sort of faith community within it, didn't have access to pastoral care or to the sort of thing, visiting the sick, all the sort of things that local churches are associated with.
Hugh, let's talk about the desire to connect. How diverse are modern religious congregations such that they promote connectedness?
Every culture on earth, throughout history, there's always been some kind of religious life within the culture, often at the heart of the culture, and that's partly to do with the stories of the faith, the myths, the stories that somehow express what the faith is about, inspire people, encourage them, and all of that. But there's another dimension to all of this, which is simply that within a faith community, people experience the sense of belonging in a way that the brightest example of belonging to human communities in general, because here there's some sort of focus. Now, it's not that everyone's going to believe all the same things. In fact, increasingly in contemporary Australia, people would not wish to be interviewed about precisely what they believe. They're here, they want to be part of the community, they want to enjoy the music, for example, or some of the theatre of a Pentecostal or a cathedral at the opposite end of the spectrum, both theatrical in their own way, and they want to hear the stories and have time for meditation, all that sort of stuff, in a group of people who they will think of as like-minded. And one of the things I discovered in the interviews I did for this book is that when people leave the church, either for reasons of some sort of crisis of faith or just the loss of belief, or spectacularly being asked to leave, which I found several examples of that, one of the things that they really miss is that sense of being with a group of like-minded people of serious purpose. You know, it's not just people, it's not just a drinking group or a footy club.
You use the word there, myth. Critics of religion think they've delivered the killer blow, the knockout blow, when they say it's all just myth. You say in this book that myth is a much misunderstood concept and it has a very concrete and positive factor. What is the importance of myth that doesn't make it fairy tale but makes it something much more important?
We have to ask ourselves why some myths endure and some fizzle out. And the answer is that these are stories that somehow resonate with us, stories in which we see some basic truth about humanity, about ourselves. So although there are some literalists within the Christian church who will say, yes, Jesus did literally walk on water or feed 5,000 people with one person's lunch, more generally, people are saying, no, it's not like that. It's not the truth of these stories, it's the truth in the stories, that there's metaphorical power in these stories that inspire us, give us insights of a spiritual kind that other stories don't. But in the modern world, we've sort of said, oh, well, if it's a myth, it's just a myth. As though, well, it's just a pack of lies. Fiction, don't worry about it. Politicians trying to fend off accusations of misdemeanors will say, no, that's all a myth. Well, I think it's time to rehabilitate myths and to recognise that myths have enormous cultural power. I mean, in the secular world, we're doing it with the Gallipoli story. The Anzac myth has now got something to do with what actually happened, but much more to do with the meaning we want to put into that story.
We referred earlier to the rising over the years number of people who've opted out of church life but wanting to send their children to non-government schools, the vast majority of which are faith-based. What explains that paradox, Hugh?
These are mainly parents who've had some connection with the church in their past but now are not churchgoers, and they're mainly among the 61% who are ticking Christian in the census. And yes, here they are sending their children to a school run by an institution that they will personally have no truck with at all. So what's behind it? Essentially, we're back to this idea of Christian values. They like the idea that their kids will be in a school environment where Christian values will be embedded. They will expect pastoral help to be available to their kids. And they explicitly say, when you ask parents of private school kids why are they there, they'll explicitly say values.
What is the value of ritual and order in religion, even for the non-religious? Because it's a strong point that comes through in your book.
Churchgoers love it. Ex-churchgoers miss it, and even non-churchgoers kind of vaguely are intrigued by it. In fact, there's a phenomenon that I identified in the book, which I called faith envy, which is people wishing they could feel all this, but not apparently being able to, and then catching a glimpse of it if they see a royal wedding on television or a state funeral or something, and they get a sense of all this stuff is going on and I'm not really part of it, and I wonder what I'm missing out on. I reached the end of this book coming to the conclusion that all the old labels about atheists and agnostics and theists really make less and less sense in a world where the Christians and the spiritual but not religious and the people who are unsure about any of that stuff, there's an enormous amount of common ground in what sort of society they want and in how to achieve it.
Hugh Mackay, always a great pleasure. Hugh's book is Beyond Belief, How We Find Meaning With or Without Religion. Hugh Mackay, thank you very much for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Andrew.
And Hugh is appearing this week at the Sydney Writers' Festival, and there's a longer version of our chat with Hugh when you download that segment and all the others from our homepage at the RN website. Thanks to producer Nadia Elgorli and technical producer Tim Jenkins. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Fran Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.